Hi, this is Marion Nessel. I'm the Paulette Goddard Professor of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University and a longtime fan of Heritage Radio.
Like Marion, you too can support Heritage Radio Network, a member-based nonprofit radio station operating out of Bushwick, Brooklyn.
I've been on it countless times. I love being interviewed. The interviewers are always really well prepared and fun to talk to about the issues that matter to me the most, about how we can change our food system to one that's healthier for people and the environment. It's just invaluable to have an independent radio station that's dealing with these issues. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful asset.
Support Heritage Radio Network by becoming a member today. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to donate.
Today's program is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. For more information, visit MOFAD.org.
I'm Laura Stanley, host of Inside School Food. You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey guys, you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, and this is Eat Your Words. I'm your host, Kathy Irway. Right now, it's the full swing of summer, so we're in the midst of a really busy harvest season. So I'm really thankful that my guest today could join us to talk about his new book. My guest today is Joel Salatin, who is a third-generation farmer who works with his family on their farm in Virginia's Shenandoah Valley. It is called Salatin Polyface Farm. And if anyone needs any further introduction to Mr. Salatin, if you read Michael Pollan's The Omnivore's Dilemma, then there's no chance that you can forget this character. So Joel was interviewed extensively for that book. And Joel has recently published a new book called The Marvelous Pigness of Pigs. We have him on the line right now. Joel, how are you?
I'm doing great, and I hope you are.
Thank you, yes. And thanks so much for joining us. Excellent book. This is a really, really... a fabulous read, and I really enjoyed every page of it. So let's talk. I just want to kind of like get folks into the topic sort of in a nutshell, if I may. You write about, yes, the marvelous pigness of pigs, but also this book you describe as a sort of coming out story. And so the other thing is you describe yourself as a self-described Christian libertarian, environmentalist, capitalist, lunatic farmer. So this is your coming out story as such. But also, I think that it's really important that you talk about bridging a sort of culture war that you've seen throughout your life.
Well, yes. Mm-hmm. The reason I call it my coming out book is because I've been known and kind of, you know, established a brand, if you will, of ecological farming, foodie, local food, that sort of thing. And so, you know, my writing, my talking has been about, you know, farming environmentally friendly and food that's local-centric and things like that. But that has not been the mantra of this other side of me, which is this, you know, conservative Christian belief system and ethic that is more often than not on a collision course and actually, you know, poo-poos and makes fun of, you know, tree huggers, environmental wackos, and things like that, and so I thought that you know I've lived with this tension all my life, and at this point I write based on what I think our culture needs to hear, not on, you know, what'll make a lot of money or what'll sell or anything, but as I travel and talk and meet people, it's you know, what do I feel like our culture needs to hear right now? And I think that the message of creation stewardship, if there was ever a time when it needs to be wrestled with by the religious right, by the evangelical community, I think is now. And it could, and if that group could embrace it, it could truly tip the scales in a lot of policy that is, you know, that is you know, opposed to you know, to long-term earth care.
Yeah, I think, you know, reading through this book, I'm quite shocked that, you know, you make it sound so natural, and there is so much common sense, there's so much common ground between being a real responsible steward of the land and animals and the environment, as well as, you know, worshiping the Christian God and, you know, promoting many other Christian beliefs that you have, that I'm actually just confused about why you seem to be kind of alone a little bit in this field.
You know, if you listen to, you know, conservative talk radio and you know, the conservative voice in that has a very strong, you know, faith-based constituency,
mm-hmm.
What you see very quickly is a pretty cavalier attitude toward,
right.
You know, toward environmentalists, toward earth stewardship, and I get that because, unfortunately, the environmental movement has grown out of a kind of a big government regulatory,
okay.
And even an earth worship framework. You know, the English Romantic poets, Bysshe Shelley, Keats. You know, mm-hmm. Never seen anything as lovely as a tree, and so the kind of au naturel movement. Well, I mean, look at the you know, look at the early 1970s with the Back to the Land, the hippies, the beaded, bearded, braless, free love. You know,
very liberal.
Kind of, Yeah. And so what happened was, I think, that this kind of environmental movement, you know, Gaia and all that,
mm-hmm.
was so steeped in creation worship that
okay.
The creator worshipers essentially demonized everything that they would say. And so if, you know, if Ralph Nader says we should clean up this stream, you know, Sean Hannity would say, "Well, no, you're an idiot." You know, I mean, so you have to dismiss everything that the other side says because you can't, you know, you can't give them any ground. And what I'm suggesting is that while I disagree very much with, you know, big government, top-down regulatory, and all that kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
I'm simply coming as a prophet saying, you believers in the creator, you know, you say it's his stuff. Well, what's his return on investment? You know, does he want undrinkable water, unbreathable air, and soil erosion? Is that what you think God would want, return on investment? And and to try to create a message that resonates with people personally, as opposed to saying, well, we need this program or that program, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
A call to a belief and an action individually. And if we could literally move the faith-based community in this country to begin matching what's on their menu with what they say they believe in the pew,
yeah.
it would empty the it would empty the food orthodoxy,
right.
That is completely bent on, you know, earth destruction, nutrient deficiency, and pharmaceuticals. And that would be a cool thing to reverse those patronage dollars from
yes.
one side and devote it to the other.
Well, you make a really compelling case for bridging this divide. I'm just curious, what about your particular upbringing in, you know, your family's farm? How did you find yourself sort of in the middle here of this culture war?
Well, of course, you know, our family, I grew up, you know, very, very conservative.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to conservative church, and we're in a conservative faith community here. And so growing up, we kind of had this double existence, you know, on our faith-based friends were... everything. Basically, anything that humans could cleverly conceive to do was fine, from genetic engineering to DDT to whatever. And here at home, though, with our farming friends, I mean, we were talking compost, and we had, marijuana smokers through the house all the time, and hippies. You know, I grew up on Adele Davis, making tiger milk. I mean, one church group we were in, Dad, we would make tiger milk here in the house, and our church friends heard about it and called it panther puke. You know, it was that kind. it was that kind of. Tension, give and take. It wasn't like I grew up angry or mad, or we were mad, or anybody hated. It was just this kind of cat and mouse game, between it grew more and more acute, through my growing up years, and now later in life, I took this mantra that you said at the top of the program, that the Christian libertarian environmentalist capitalist lunatic, several years ago, after being so frustrated so often at when I was introduced to speak, the assumption was, oh, here's this organic farmer, so he must be for Democrats, liberals, big government, abortion, that sort of thing. And so kind of in self-deprecating self-defense, I kind of created that moniker to say, okay, folks, there's a big world, and we can bridge this divide, and I'm the bridge, and don't put me in a box. And it's created the opportunity for conversations that usually don't occur in either people that are, radical environmentalists or people who are, very steeped in the faith-based community. They usually don't talk to each other, and I'm finding myself able to irritate both sides and be friendly with both sides. And so that's kind of cool.
I think that's really cool. And, here at Heritage Radio Network, I think we couldn't be more liberal and democratic, but I think this is actually a really fascinating read. However, am I sort of not your target audience here, or do you think there's great value in reaching out to folks who are, might not see all sides of the culture war? Do you think that there's a lot to be gained there? And you mentioned a really cool talk that you gave at UC Berkeley, where if I could describe this incident, as you describe it in the book, you sort of like this student body was known for hissing at people when they mentioned the word God, and they didn't do that at all. Instead, they gave you a standing ovation at the end of your lecture, even though you mentioned God several times. And, what do you think went through the students' minds? How did they get touched by your words, or how did they find something, that resonated with them?
Yes, well, I think that for many of them, for the first time in their life, they encountered a faith-based person who cared about things that they cared about, and unfortunately, too many in the faith-based community take an accentuated kind of dominion, dominion manipulative stand over the physical universe, and essentially have a limitless or a boundless concept of, God put me here and in charge, and anything I want to do, I can do. And it's very innovative. It's very innovative to be able to conquer the earth, conquistador. I mean, the whole conquistador thing was in the name of God, right? I mean, while they're killing the Incas, this is in the name of God, right? The Crusades. I mean, the pillaging that's occurred in the name of God is certainly as big as the pillaging that's occurred in the name of any other deity or any other religion.
I think
I deeply appreciate that, and and understand that our first, I feel like, as a faith-based community, the first thing we need to do for whatever credibility, respect in the radical liberal kind of environmental community, the first thing we need to do is repent about the sins of our past and be honest about it.
Yeah.
Then let's come to the table and say, okay, all right, you know, we have done a bunch of terrible things. We're going to put that behind us. Now, how can we heal? How can we heal these things? Because you know, the radical environmentalists have been talking about healing the earth for a long time. Now, there's you know, my side would typically say, well, the answer is not a government agency. We would say the answer is personal responsibility. How can we message personal responsibility forward? So we still have our disagreements from a large policy standpoint.
Okay.
But goodness, we can't even sit down at a table. Look, if I walk into the regular church in America right now and say, you know, instead of at the next potluck, instead of having styrofoam plates, why don't we use paper? Or better yet, why don't we go down to the Salvation Army store and get a bunch of mismatched plates, dinner plates, and wash them in the sink so there's no waste in the trash can.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the head elder's going to grab me by the arm, usher me out, and start calling me a commie pinko, one of them, you know, earth muffin kind of folks. And we can't even have a conversation.
Right.
And so my hope with this book is that that both sides will appreciate that we would both be better off if we can have a conversation.
You're absolutely right. We all need to check ourselves and our stereotypes and our preconceived notions and so forth. Well, thank you so much, Joel. We're going to have a quick little commercial interlude, and we'll be right back chatting more with you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Strangers to the great divide.
Welcome all you strangers to the great divide. They say salvation's on the other side. Some will run and some will hide. Welcome all you strangers to the great divide.
Hi, this is Peter Kim, the executive director of MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. We're a nonprofit founded by Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues here on the Heritage Radio Network, and we want to take people on a learning adventure through the world of food. We just opened MOFAD Lab, our gallery space at 62 Bayard Street in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, where we are currently showing Flavor, Making It and Faking It. Flavor features some very cool sensory interaction. Flavor tablets deliver tastings of vanilla and umami, and the Willy Wonka-inspired smell synth lets you compose over 500,000 different flavors. So come on by and visit MOFAD Lab. We're open 5 days a week, and tickets are $5 for kids and $10 for adults. Learn more about the Museum of Food and Drink at mofad.org.
All right, we're back. This is Eat Your Words, and I'm so honored to be chatting with Joel Salatin, who's the author most recently of The Marvelous Pigness of Pigs. Subtitle is Respecting and Caring for All God's Creation. Thanks so much, Joel, for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's delightful to be with you.
Absolutely. So I'm curious, why dedicate this book to the pigness of pigs? Is there anything about pigs that just captures your, that speaks to you more than, say, perhaps the cowness of cows, chickenness of chickens?
Yeah, well, number one, it's a nice short word to say. It's a lot shorter than chickens.
Okay, yeah, chickenness.
I guess, generally speaking, pigs have probably been abused, or I mean, they're kind of considered. They do like the dirt, right? I mean, they're like the lowest, the lowest of the animals, of the farm animals, and so I picked pigness of pigs, and I think partly because over the years when we do farm tours here, when I address this topic, it's always with the pigs because I'm showing people how we use pigs to build compost, and you know, they're turning and churning and rooting and all that, and the pigs are behind me. And I end with this crescendo of bigness of pigs. You know, it's the point.
Yeah.
And so I've always just used that as my, you know, as my thing on tours, and so it was easy to use it as a title. But, yes, it could have been the tomatoness of tomatoes. It could have been anything, but that would have sounded kind of long.
All God's creation equal. But actually, pigs... I find that a lot of farmers I know have a sort of a friendship with their pigs. They're one of the most intelligent animals, sort of like dogs.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. They are. They're the most considered the most intelligent of the farm animals. And and this friendship, you know, one of the things I think that should be understood about this friendship is that these pigs are omnivores, and so unlike any, they're the only farm animal that if you go in and lie down with them for an hour, they will literally eat you. So when I say, you know, we need to respect the bigness of pigs, you know, I'm picking the one animal on the farm that that could actually do me in if I went in and quit moving. And, you know, a cow, you could die in a cow pen and they'd never eat you, you know. Chickens, they might peck your eyes out, but they're not going to, you know, eat you up very much. But a pig, you know, pigs, pretty quick, they'll, you know, I tell kindergartners that come, I say, now remember, kids, these are omnivores, so keep moving. Let them know that you're alive.
That is extremely humbling to remember. It's a good thing. Okay, so changing topics just a little bit, because you've mentioned GMO a few times. I'm really curious to hear what your thoughts are on the recent GMO bill that some folks are calling sort of like the industry-backed bill, and it's a watered-down version of what sort of GMO labelists, if you will, are trying to do with GMO labeling.
Right, right. Well, what this bill does is my understanding is that it supersedes state sovereignty in being able to pass GMO bills of a state's choosing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, by giving them, by telling the state, well, you can't pass any rules, and if you do, it has to be under this one, which includes it, you know, that you can't make anybody put it on the label. It can be in the whatever that little barcode thing
is. Yeah, and you can't see it and or read it.
So it can be very, very hidden. Look, I'm a huge states' rights advocate. Huge states' rights. I think, and the reason for that, and this is maybe a good example, the reason for that is because when you don't have things done at the federal level, it gives a lot of room for experimentation. And innovation comes out of experimentation. And one of the problems, I think, in our country, the reason we have such divides and dissension right now is because we have, in fact, arrogated so many policy issues to the federal level. So it's a winner take all. It's a one size fits all, and so it's for all the marbles. Mm. Whereas if these battles from, you know, name your battle, from minimum wage to gay rights to GMO labeling to whatever, if these battles were fought at the state level, then we would actually have the option for 50 different types of experiments. And if you truly want innovation in a culture, if you really want innovation to happen, then what you want is to shove the decision-making possibility down to as decentralized an option as possible and minimize the centralized decisions so that you can have way, way more diversity and way, way more trials in a decentralized decision-making model.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as an ecologist, you know, we know that the more different kinds of plants and animals we have on our farm, the stronger it is, mm-hmm. because there are way more plants and animals expressing their gifts and talents, you know, on the farm. And the same thing is true politically, that,
right. Okay.
That if we push those decisions down to a lower, a local and a state level, then suddenly we have lots of different possibilities and people, oh, look what they're doing over there. Oh, look what they're doing. Oh, that's it. I don't like what they're doing over there. That's bad, you know. Oh, but they're doing a neat job over there. Maybe we could do what they do. And just imagine all the experimentation we could have. It'd be like having honeybees, cows, and tomatoes and peppers all on the same farm. Oh. It's cool.
Wow. That is a really great, interesting argument against the recent GMO bill. You know, a lot of people are saying that, you know, if this bill were not implemented, because Vermont passed successfully this GMO labeling bill, that, you know, industry we'd be forced to label across the board. So this was their way of kind of avoiding that. But that's a really interesting perspective as well. Yeah.
Yes. Well, what's fascinating to me is that before Vermont did this, if you'll recall, the Monsantoites in the culture said that, you know, Vermont would all starve to death because no company would label just for Vermont.
Uh-huh.
And the fact is it wasn't even a blip. It wasn't even a blip.
Yeah.
I think just generally, the more differences, diversity that you allow, the better, more resilient, and better ideas you can come up with. I think it's great to have a lot of choices out there.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for sharing your perspective on that. That was really, really interesting. And thank you so much for talking more about this book. It's a great pleasure to have you here on Heritage to talk about it. That's about all the time we have for today. But do check out The Marvelous Pigness of Pigs, and we'll be reading more from you, hopefully, in the future as well. Thanks so much, Joel.
It's been delightful to be with you. Thank you.
Absolutely. See everyone at Heritage Radio Network next week on Eat Your Words.
Ooh, I like the way you do.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.